Good morning. Well, we're minus one moderator, but we're going to proceed without, and hopefully Ross Silverman will join us shortly. My name is Michelle Mello. I'm coming from Stanford today, and I'm very excited to open this really terrific panel that challenges us to think systematically and creatively about how to better use the law as a tool for population health improvement. To this room, it's not a tough sell to argue that public health law is a key tool in our arsenal against major health threats. And indeed, when we look at how the CDC characterizes the 10 great public health achievements of the last century, as Tony Moulton and his colleagues have noted, law was a critical component in the success that we achieved in every one of these 10. So while law can be extremely powerful, we also know that there are areas where law is underutilized as a tool for public health improvement, either because legal approaches are not widely disseminated or because they're poorly implemented. And what I want to argue today is that it's our case to make for smarter, intelligent use of law to improve public health, and that there's a systematic approach that we can offer for doing so. Why isn't the law doing more in public health? I think we can point to a variety of reasons, but certainly one at the top is just the rather ad hoc nature of lawmaking generally, and in public health in particular, tends to be responsive to the policy problem of the moment. There's not a great deal of deliberative reflection about priority setting within this space, particularly in the legislature. And so it's not that the best ideas necessarily rise to the top, but that ideas get on the policy agenda in a variety of unsystematic ways. A second problem is information gaps. We certainly have epistemic gaps even within the research community, but of course the larger problem is that our policymakers don't have access to the information they need to evaluate one policy idea against another. We lack evidence, at least accessible evidence, about the effectiveness of a lot of public health legal interventions, and we particularly lack evidence about the cost effectiveness relative to other possible investments that we could make. And then finally, and perhaps most notably, is the political opposition, particularly that which is fueled by industries that might be regulated by new public health laws. We've seen this in a most pronounced way in the nutrition space, as initiatives like Mayor Bloomberg's have really faced enormous backlash from putative consumer groups that are backed by the food and beverage industry to the tune of millions of dollars. So overcoming this political opposition and making the case that law is advisable, that it can be successful, and that it doesn't mean a never-ending encroachment of government into people's lives is the case that we all have to make. So the questions for our field really are, what are the most promising legal interventions, and how do we build that case by demonstrating both effectiveness and feasibility of those interventions? That is the enterprise that public health law practice and research faces. And answering these questions becomes all the more important when we realize that traditionally the targets of public health law are health threats that are no longer our major killers. When we look at the causes of death in the United States today, overwhelmingly, we are dying due to non-communicable diseases. What this chart shows here is the distribution of deaths. The blue is non-communicable disease, like ischemic heart disease, strokes, cancer. The red is infectious disease, like lower respiratory infections. And the green is injuries. Traditionally, the targets of public health law, aside from environmental toxins, have been infectious disease and accidental injuries. Today, our task is different, and there is a wealth of possibility for new roles for law intervening in the major killers, but we are not there yet. So how do we get there? In order to get closer to where we want to be, I think the key is to develop a sense of how to identify the key targets for public health lawmaking. And so my colleagues at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's National Program Office in Public Health Law Research and I, including Scott Burris and Jeff Swanson, who are here today, want to propose that we engage in and initiate a national conversation about these important targets. Critical opportunities are areas where public health law is simply underperforming, either because we lack legal interventions, they're simply absent, or they're simply less widely distributed than they could or should be, or sometimes there are areas where we've made use of law, but that law has misfired in various ways. Either it's wrongly designed, it's wrongly or incompletely implemented, or it has side effects, collateral effects that are so overwhelmingly negative that it causes us to rethink the entire approach. So this is the target, finding laws that fit this description, and we'd like to propose a set of criteria for getting there. There are a few things, though, that I want to emphasize critical opportunities are not. It does not necessarily in all cases mean that we are advocating for more legal intervention. I often find from my colleagues on the right that being in public health, and particularly in public health law, is often viewed as synonymous with advocating an expansion of government's presence in people's lives. And their argument is always, why not the market? Well, in some cases, I think it behooves us to acknowledge areas in which we need less law and less government intervention. Things are actually going awry, and that may be where some critical opportunities point us. At the same time, though, I think it would be wrong to suggest that we have to wait for the market to fail before it's legitimate for government to intervene. So part of making the case for critical opportunities is showing that official action is justified from an ethical perspective where we feel confident it will prevent harm. And we don't need to wait for humans and markets to fail and cause harm for the government to step in. Not in all cases does a critical opportunity require that there be a robust evidence base supporting an intervention. Of course, it's great if there is. The more evidence we can muster in favor of an intervention, the easier it is to make the political case for it. But we'd argue that the degree of evidence needs to be calibrated to the urgency of the harm that we want to prevent. And in some cases, we cannot wait for an evidence base to accrete in order to act. And it's justified to intervene with a plausible intervention that is carefully evaluated along the way. So we want to be able to propose interventions that have a mechanism effect that makes sense, that has face validity, that has some suggestive evidence, and start with small-scale experiments and evaluate them carefully to scale them up. Finally, focusing on critical opportunities, which brings to mind a short-term policy response to a problem, doesn't mean ignoring the long game in public health and public health law. There are some interventions that are not feasible at this time, for legal, constitutional, or political reasons. For example, a lot of what we would advocate in the gun control space, or regulation of advertising, simply faces insurmountable barriers at the present time. But that doesn't mean ignoring them as a critical opportunity for tomorrow. Again, we may need to work towards that, building an evidence base with incremental interventions along the way. So what is a critical opportunity? How do we know one when we see one? We'd like to propose three criteria. These are not controversial and they're not novel. But what is new is the suggestion that policymakers ought to systematically apply them when selecting among interventions. The first is that a critical opportunity addresses a problem of great public health significance. It may not be a major killer, but it is something that is dramatically impacting the people's lives and creating a high burden of disease. And that's a function of how common the harm condition is, the severity of the harm, and we may wish to give special consideration to health conditions that disproportionately burden vulnerable populations. Second, we have to be able to argue that this health problem is plausibly amenable to change through law, because it's caused by a behavior or a condition or another determinant that we think could be influenced by law. And that doesn't describe all interventions at this, or all health problems at this point in time. So we need to be able to articulate a mechanism. And then finally, of course, there needs to be an intervention identified. And that intervention has got to have plausibility, which means we can make the case that it's likely to be effective. We can make the case that there are not at present insurmountable legal barriers towards moving forward. That doesn't mean that there are no legal barriers or that this intervention would go unchallenged in court. Sometimes those fights are worth fighting. But if this is a non-starter from a constitutional perspective, it's not a critical opportunity. And finally, we need to be able to show that if there is political opposition to this, it could be overcome in time with appropriate communications and strategy and evidence building. But hopefully we can identify interventions for which the political barriers are relatively low. So let me conclude by offering a couple of examples of what we in the National Program Office think are some critical opportunities. These are in no way an exhaustive list, but merely illustrative of the range of problems and approaches that critical opportunities can take. First, my colleague Alex Wagenaar has pointed out the opportunity of increasing state alcohol taxes. Every state in the nation has some kind of tax on alcohol, but typically these are ad valorem taxes, that means a set amount per gallon, and they haven't been indexed to inflation over time. That means that in real terms, over the last few decades, most states' alcohol taxes have decreased by 25 to 50%. This is an intervention for which we have a robust evidence base, but because of poor implementation, we're not getting the mileage out of it that we could. So it clearly addresses an enormously significant public health problem. Alcohol-related disease and injuries are the third leading preventable cause of death in the United States. The mechanism for taxes to affect consumption is well established. We know that they lead to increases in price, which are associated with drops in consumption. And we even know the order of the effect. For about a 10% increase in price, we will see a 5% drop in consumption. And we know that is large enough to affect health outcomes. The evidence base is mature and robust for this intervention because it has so long been in place in so many different forms across the states. The legal barriers are virtually absent, since this would simply be raising an existing tax. And in terms of political feasibility, taxes are never popular with those that they burden. And in some states, the alcohol lobby has resisted attempts to raise the tax. In other states, they have not. And in times of fiscal constraint, one can make the argument that this is a revenue-generating measure that may be sufficient to overcome resistance from the industry. So it's a highly feasible and effective intervention. And really what we're talking about here is tweaks in something that states have already done. Tweaks that could be enormously powerful. Now let me give an example of a critical opportunity that means we want less law. We could, as Scott Burris and colleagues have suggested, remove legal barriers to laypersons administering opioid overdose reversal interventions. The opportunities here are, for example, to adopt Good Samaritan laws that provide immunity from criminal prosecution to those who aid and report an overdose, and also to remove state legal barriers to laypersons obtaining and administering naloxone, a reversal agent which is extremely effective in stopping the harms associated with opioid overdose, but in most states requires a prescription, and anyone who administers it as a layperson can be criminally prosecuted. Again, we have an enormously significant health problem, and one that is growing in scale. And there is a clear mechanism for affecting this, both on the supply side and on the overdose side. And the supply side, states have been focusing intently on tightening up rules around prescribing and supporting physicians through prescription drug monitoring programs in wisely prescribing opioids. But there's also an opportunity to intervene to prevent harm among those who do take opioids. And the law, we know, can empower bystanders to act, and it can also disempower them. At present, it is disempowering them, and removing these legal barriers can really open up the prospect of preventing a great deal of deaths. This is an early stage intervention in terms of building the evidence base. We have suggestive evidence from a number of states who have programs like this. They claim prevention of 10,000 overdose deaths since 1996. It has high face validity as an intervention, and we know from research that people who get this naloxone are willing to retain it and they're willing to use it. So we have enough evidence to proceed, at least with broader scale experimentation. The legal barriers really are none. This is simply removing barriers that are already in place. And although the politics around substance abuse can be dicey, the fact that so many victims of overdose are medical users or children provides a powerful political frame that may be used to overcome opposition. And many states have been successful in doing so without significant opposition. So here's an example where doing less with legal intervention can actually facilitate powerful public health gains. So to summarize, there are really significant benefits in thinking more systematically about where to intervene with public health law. It can enhance the legitimacy of law as a tool in the public health arsenal by, for example, clearly establishing what our return on investment is, how much health are we going to be buying, and at what price, through the kind of accretion of evidence base that we've been talking about. And it can also help address concerns about the ever-expanding net of big government by showing that there are concrete benefits to allowing a broader government presence in people's lives. It can also help support more strategic choices in policymaking, which is very important in a crowded and noisy policy space. And it can spark a frontal and open debate about the trade-offs that we're making in choosing among policy options. And it can bridge those information gaps that are keeping policy from being evidence-based. So it's incumbent on us to make the case that we have smart, powerful ideas in public health law that fit these criteria. And if we can do that, we can really maximize the power of our field and of the law to improve population health.